Welcome to the Sports Pro Podcast.
Hi everyone, and welcome once again to the Sports Pro Podcast. My name is Owen Connolly. I'm the editor at large at Sports Pro. Hope you've had a very good week indeed. I am back to lead you through a bit of a recap of the second day of the Sports Pro OTT Summit USA, bringing you some more fascinating perspectives on the effects of digital disruption on sports media. The event is done now for another year. Thanks up front to everyone for making it a huge success, and we hope a lot of use for all of you who attended. We've got some great stuff to come once again from the virtual stage, with insights from CONCACAF on aligning a media strategy with responsibilities to a sports community, from Formula E on bringing the valuable audiences of the future within your reach, from Sinclair on the implications of gamification, and from TikTok on making the most of the creativity on the world's buzziest video platform. We also have a chat coming up with Lou Bolden, Chief Revenue Officer at Verimatrix, about the digital security picture. But we'll start our podcast from the top, the opening session of day two, which was a State of the Union conversation featuring PGA Tour Chief Media Officer Rick Anderson, ESPN EVP of Programming, Acquisitions and Scheduling Burke Magnus, and SportsPro's very own Managing Director Nick Meacham. Over the course of the session, they ran through the partnerships between the two organisations and their own digital broadcast activities. But we're going to pick up the discussion towards the end, where Nick opened things out to the broader US media landscape. We'll join for a question on the entry of new digital MVPD platforms and the OTT services launched by Legacy Media's Big Beasts, and take it from there to the close.
Sports Pro. Connecting and inspiring the business world of sport.
Good stuff. So we've got about 15 minutes left. So I really want to get into a bit of the nuances of the landscape, as that's what the session is dubbed. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about what are your respective takes on these new aggregator platforms coming into the market, the MVPDs of the world. What role are they going to play? Because at the same time, we're now seeing the big media businesses creating their own streaming platforms. We've seen the deals like the WWE deal with Peacock, $1 billion over 5 years to become an exclusive home for their content. What's your sense or feel of those MVPD platforms and their role versus the more of the traditional guys out there? Will they be the home for consumption moving forward? Or do you think it will be largely business as usual, come full circle again, and the big guys will be standing out from the crowd? Maybe if we start with you, Burke.
Yeah, I don't know that there's a single answer to it, obviously. I mean, a lot of the reporting on this makes it appear that, or makes it sound as if one day we're just going to wake up and everything's going to be changed. And it, you know, business doesn't work that way. It's obviously, you guys know that, everyone knows that it's an evolution. You know, it's optionality in terms of, you know, trying to forecast where, you know, where the business is going and where where customers might be. Everything we've done, you know, in that regard is oriented towards trying to reach fans where they are. You know, we are still very committed to the, you know, to the multi-channel subscription universe through, you know, traditional cable, satellite, telco. We don't believe that's going anywhere. But at the same time, we've made a huge priority, and it's obvious to, I think, the world, not just in sports, but entertainment, film and television media. It's not even an exaggeration to say we've reoriented the entire Walt Disney Company during this pandemic, you know, to position you know, ourselves for that future. And so it's everything we do now, you know, is looked at from a media and entertainment perspective as looked at through the lens of direct-to-consumer subscription and how does it fit? Which doesn't mean, you know, as Bob Chapek has said, you know, on various occasions, doesn't mean we're exiting, you know, other businesses, whether that's, you know, movie theater distribution on the entertainment side or whether it's, you know, the MVPD ecosystem on the cable side. I think, you know, I mean, who knows what the answer is, but we think the world's going to settle into a place where, you know, consumers are going to have several options available to them. And right now, we're just happy that we seem to be reaping a certain benefit from being a first mover among our peers in pushing towards that place. Rick mentioned some of the timing on other products related to sports. And then lastly, I'll say, you know, when we go into sports rights conversations, we think we have a really compelling pitch, right? Which is, we're not just one thing, right? We can offer a sports property. And again, it's not a one size fits all model, because we do things across all of this at some level, but we can talk to people about broadcast network distribution on ABC, you know, fully penetrated cable television distribution on multiple ESPN networks, you know, our digital ESPN app, ESPN.com, our social platforms are, you know, have an enormous lead on everyone else in the sports segment. And now we have ESPN Plus, which is out to a pretty sizable lead on the sports direct-to-consumer front. So we just want to be everywhere that sports fans can possibly be, and anticipate from a business perspective where, you know, where the business is going to be in terms of, you know, making it, you know, beneficial for us from a business perspective.
Absolutely. Now, looking at one of the other areas that keeps coming up everywhere, particularly in discussions around the U.S. Sports market, is obviously betting and gambling and its impact and the growth opportunities around that. PGA Tour's taken made a few interesting moves. Rick, could you tell us a bit of detail of what you've already worked through with PointsBet and with NBC and so forth, and talk about how that successful that's been and some of the nuances of what you guys have been trying and testing in that marketplace.
Yeah, sure. We are huge believers in the benefit of legal sports betting. We were delighted to see that start to happen in sort of a landslide way in the United States. And, you know, Jay Monahan, our commissioner from the beginning, you know, said that we want to be in that space. We launched our integrity program 3 years before we did actually any commercial deals in the space. And so we want to make sure we're careful. And I would say that is kind of the theme that we have right now. You know, we have a significant data deal with IMG Arena and have been working with them to bring products to market outside of the U.S. We are working with them in North America now as well. And so data, which is another great asset of ours with our ShotLink scoring system and all the rich data that we have, we see, you know, even before you get to video and other types of content, just our data advantage in the space. You also see just the nature of our sport, where, you know, you hit a shot and there's a break and you then you go and hit another shot. It lends itself to betting down the road. And so we think the opportunity is huge. What we're doing at the moment beyond the deal with IMG Arena is we've started to have some official betting operator deals in place in the US, and we're focused on a number of fronts with experimenting with betting content. Right. So I think for ourselves and probably for most of the major media companies, we're not going to get in the business of being, you know, transacting bets. But I think what we want to do on the content side is for that segment of our audience that really loves to bet, or for people who love to bet that may come to us when they weren't otherwise really watching the PGA Tour. We want to facilitate that. We want to deliver them content. And so, you know, the things that you've been seeing us do in the market work, whether it be with Peacock or Action Network, with official betting operator deals, are us experimenting with that and seeing how what resonates with fans. And I would also say, you know, we're being very careful to protect our core audience and not inundate them with betting content when they may not want it. And that's one of the things that we want to be very careful about and experiment with, is what's the right balance. And we do have the ability to really segregate betting content from our core product if we decide, you know, that's sort of what our fans prefer. And we expect to work with all of our partners globally, Golf TV, CBS, NBC Golf Channel, and ESPN Plus in the betting space. Whether it's whatever products we can bring to life. And we plan to do that with our partners. We're really excited about it. So I feel like we're at the very cusp of it. It feels like we've done so much already in the space, and the team that's working on that is doing a great job, and we're working really hard at it. But we're really at the beginning, and it's going to be exciting to see where it leads.
Burke, what are you guys doing on the betting front? I mean, also we're seeing a whole host of different deals being rolled out from rights owners' perspective, but also from broadcasters. I think some interesting deals that I think everyone's looking at or plans are ones like Fubo TV. Again, I spoke to David Ganley yesterday on during the summit, and talking about they're fully integrating a sports book into the platform, which they aren't, it seems like they're quite a way away from. What's ESPN and also Disney's take on that sort of level of integration? Or will you see it more of as a, I guess, more of a traditional partnership format for the moment?
Yeah, to start, we really see it as three things. There's an obvious fan engagement aspect to this, which I think just happens organically as legalized gambling rolls out over the U.S. Remember, it has a ways to go until it's a truly national proposition. But that we think that'll happen inevitably, and it'll happen fairly quickly. So we're not pretending it's not coming. It is. There's no doubt. So we think that fans will be just naturally more engaged across various content in a deeper way, which will contribute to audience and usage increases, which is fantastic. There's a second is a content filter here. We think there's a real role for us to play to make gambling information available to fans so that they can be more informed if they do gamble. And so we've launched a show already on ESPN2 that's daily from a studio in Las Vegas that we did with our partner, just Caesars William Hill. And there'll be more content that'll roll out that'll be both discrete standalone programming, but also integrated into our existing programs, news and information in particular. And then there's an obvious advertising and sponsorship angle to this that we think will benefit from, you know, these entities trying to reach fans through our platform. And the downstream thing is what you just mentioned relative to Fubo, which is we are still part of the Walt Disney Company. I think we have some brand considerations there that are not insignificant, and so we're taking perhaps a more cautious approach to how we may be involved directly or indirectly, you know, in a transactional element at some point. But that's still also, obviously, I think for us, there's a tipping point from a national distribution or national legalization perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. I only got a couple minutes left, so I want to quickly go through a few final bits and one or two questions from the audience if we can. I'd be remiss not to bring it up, Burke, but obviously there's been a lot of reports around what's happening on the NFL rights side that's been covered across multiple platforms, but nothing has been announced formally by the NFL or any of the major broadcasters. We're seeing reports of a lot of the major players are still winning the rights, but with Amazon taking on exclusive rights, which is obviously quite a big deal for them to make that move from what they have been doing. Can you shed any light from your perspective? Where is that negotiation and situation now? Is it a little bit too premature, or is it as reported by some, all done and dusted?
You probably won't be surprised by this, but the reports were premature. I think every sports media writer in the U.S. is trying to break the story, and so they're running with nuggets of information that are perhaps incomplete. No, it's not done. We're not there. The NFL, you know, obviously the process has been going on for some time. That's no secret. People have made comments about it. We've made comments about it in terms of its significance to our business and how what a priority it is for us. But no, it's not. It's we're not done until you see that press release, which is coming at some point, I hope.
One thing I did want to touch on, not just associated with that deal, but also more widely, the big blue chip rights deals. I think the deal, this is, you know, significant, 10, 11 years, I think, from when the deal is going to be in place for the rights moving forward. There's speculation is just generally that the premium rights deals are going to see quite a big jump in value. But in markets like Europe and the UK and other further afield, the premium deals are seeing very much a flattening or even a dip. Why do you think, at least from your point of view, that we are seeing that increase value being derived from the premium rights still, when in other markets they are taking a bit of a hit? Is there anything that you can point the finger at that you could shed some light on, Burke?
Premium content, I think, will always drive premium consideration or compensation, right? But I think that's counterbalanced a little bit by the fact that every company now has to make their priorities, right? And pick their partners wisely, because there's nobody who's in a position to have everything or do everything. But there's incredible healthy competition. We're at a moment where, a lot of entities are building new businesses, direct to consumer, obviously being, first and foremost. And so there's robust competition, and that's where that drives price on the premium content. But at the same time, there's a lot of deals that are, all of our deals, frankly, have to be disciplined and have to fit into our projections and our strategy for the future. So we think, we think long and hard about where we're going to place our bets. And, that portfolio has changed with the advent of direct to consumer, which I'm actually really excited about, because it's gotten us involved in some things that I think will really drive this new business. But the blue chip is always going to be the blue chip, and I think that will be reflected in the overall fee growth. But again, we're focused on doing smart, disciplined deals that'll pay off and grow our business at the end of the day.
Join the conversation with the Sports Pro community. Follow us on Twitter at Sports Pro. Find us on Instagram at sportspro.media. And connect to Sports Pro Media on LinkedIn, where you can also become a part of our specialist OTT community. Sports Pro, connecting and inspiring the business world of sport.
Welcome back to this review of day two at the Sports Pro OTT Summit USA. Time to catch up now again with one of the platinum partners of the event, Verimatrix, a trusted provider of security for digital content, applications, and devices. Verimatrix Chief Revenue Officer Lou Bolden, who regular listeners might remember, was a panelist at the summit talking about taking on piracy in 2021. And I caught up with him after his appearance to get his thoughts on that session, on how the event had evolved and reflected his ideas on digital security, and on keeping up with the demands of ever more integrated digital video experiences. Let's take a listen.
This is the Sports Pro Podcast.
Lou Bolden, Chief Revenue Officer at Verimatrix. Welcome back to the Sports Pro Podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. How has your experience of Sports Pro OTT USA been?
Well, it's been fantastic. I've actually taken part in a number of these, and this one was very, very interesting. There were a great group of panelists. The interaction with the panelists was really good. I saw a whole bunch of Q&A, and I was really impressed with the knowledge of everyone that spoke and the topics for this event. Coming out of the global pandemic, there's so much, hopefully we're coming out of it, there's so much going on, and OTT's exploding in sport everywhere now that sport's back. So it was really exciting to hear the perspective of everybody, not just rights holders, but distributors and technology companies.
Yeah, and you've taken part in your panel session today. What were some of the key lessons from that time?
You know, I think one of the key things here was education. Education of not only the market itself, but also the consumers. And we can use all the technology we have available, but if we don't educate the consumers, educate the market, and look to try to get some sort of enforcement of piracy and to prosecute, right? Then all the security in the world doesn't do anything. So it was a really interesting topic that we came and talked about outside of just the technology and the general problem that we had there. One of the other really interesting things that came out of not just the session that I was in, but some of the other sessions, is that the traditional methods of distribution are going to stay. Mm. While the focus is on OTT, and that's really the growth, it is an additional path for distribution, not a total replacement.
Yeah, so with that in mind, how does that affect what you guys are doing on the security side?
Well, you know, I think it actually puts us in a really good space because, you know, at Verimatrix, we started out protecting the traditional distribution models, whether that was from the rights holder to their distributors and from those distributors, you know, to their end consumers. And so in the OTT space, when the rights holders are going direct to consumer, we can protect and help secure that content and prevent as much as possible that piracy, and also potentially provide as OTT consumption and streaming consumption becomes more ubiquitous, then we can do an end-to-end security flow, whether it's through a distributor or direct to consumer from the rights holders, which provides additional layers of security because there's no air gaps in the security of that particular content.
Mm. How does that affect the role of each partner in the whole broadcast process, the rights holder, the broadcaster, as well as yourselves as the service provider? How are you working together in order to improve security in that way?
Yeah, so what's really neat about this particular concept is that it doesn't change the roles and the interaction necessarily of the rights holder with their direct-to-consumer or the distributor, say the pay TV operator or broadcaster, with their relationship with the consumer. What it does, though, is it because in OTT, and it's actually very particular to OTT and streaming, is that the consumption of OTT is the same regardless. And there's no reason to ever have an air gap, a time when that's encrypted, unencrypted, because you can authorize your distributor and the end user in whatever platform there are, even if the distributor is the rights holder's direct to consumer. So what it does is it allows an exploration of new business models. It accelerates revenue while ensuring that the content is as secure as possible, because that control, watermarking, DRM, output controls on the devices are all set by the rights holder, with their through their contracts that they have with the distributors. And it's done technically instead of with a paper contract that you can't really enforce and ensure is being implemented by the distributor. Mm.
Just staying with your panel for now, I mean, what were some of the other things that you learned? What were some of the solutions that your fellow panelists put forward that were interesting to you, or that you know, perhaps with things that gave you a bit of optimism about what's going on in your space?
Yeah, I think one of the things that that the Professional Fight League person Daniel mentioned was that making it easy to access the content is key, right? And that comes down to being able to quickly authorize a customer regardless of where they are. If the content can be accessed easily in a legal manner, it will dramatically reduce piracy. There was another panel I watched. It was a piracy panel, and 24% of illegal streamers, people that are watching streams illegally, would switch to a legal service if it was easy to do. It's hard to watch sometimes a professional fight, UFC, if you're not in your home on a very static kind of pay TV experience to find your username, passwords, log in. Where do I go to ESPN Plus? Mm. Is that available on, you know, how do you do that on your particular devices? And can it go in 4K to your big screen? So there are a lot of technical barriers that we make it hard for our consumers to get the content. As a sports fan myself, I know whether it's out of market or in market. And if we can make it easy, they'll pay for it. Then you'll be able to track the advertisements that come along with it, which is a big revenue driver for sports. And then you keep the revenue model alive, which then allows everyone to provide a better experience.
And again, from your perspective on the security side, that process of making the content more accessible, what challenges does that create for you? You know, when you have a user whose experience needs to be more fluid, how do you make sure that that everything's being protected at all stages of that journey?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is to do it just so that the DRM and they're using dual factor authentication or something like that. But we haven't made that as smooth and seamless as we can, while also providing the security that's needed to make sure it isn't pirated. One example would be credential fraud. And credential fraud, there's a way to reduce credential fraud by, for example, for your apps saying, hey, you need to use biometrics instead of a username and password. Username and passwords can be sold on the black market, but biometrics can't. Right. So there's other ways to do that and implement that that actually makes it easier for that end consumer. If they are legally watching that stream, I don't have to remember a username and password, log into another service or something like that, log into a website and QR codes to get into my particular piece of content. So it can make it easier and more secure if you set the parameters that fit the needs of both the consumer and the broadcaster or rights holder.
What else did you learn about your sector this week at OTT USA?
Well, it's growing, and not everybody's sure they want to get in the market as fast as we would expect them to. I listened to a number of panels where rights holders were holding off, still embracing, I would say not going direct to consumer that fast, still embracing while enabling OTT through their distributors, but not jumping in to it directly because they might not get the biggest bang for the buck. So the traditional model of working through a distributor or a broadcaster and allowing them to then go OTT is still strong, even though we're hearing a lot about direct to consumer from some of your larger brands, but the niche brands still have a challenge in getting the broadest audience possible. And that may be through your pay TV operator or broadcast partner.
And what was your highlight of the event, or what were some of your highlights of the event?
Well, I think one of them was that people are willing to pay, you know, that if we make it easy, that people are willing to pay and that those statistics are out there. I was surprised with a statistic that there's 47,000 new streaming sites. And then I was also encouraged in listening to Burke Magnus that the traditional programming is and distribution models aren't going to go away. Mm. You know, the while you want to make it easy to consume any place, anytime, anywhere on any device, you know, the one-to-many distribution that's needed for a lot of the world for good communications and to get that great sports content out to the masses is still going to be available for some time to come. Movies haven't gone away. Radio hasn't gone away. Broadcast won't go away, but the primary method of consumption will migrate to OTT over the coming years.
Yeah. And of course, I guess at the same time, what OTT is, what we've been learning from a few people this week is there are other routes to monetization that they're looking to pursue, whether that's other transactions that people do during a broadcast, if that's merchandising, or I think something David Gandler suggested was perhaps integrating, you know, food delivery or something like that in a broadcast stream. Again, from a security perspective, does that change the job that you have if you've got other transactions going on within the stream, or is it a part of the whole process still?
No, it absolutely does change it. You know, it's interesting when you think about where OTT started. You know, it primarily started as TV everywhere, right? So it was a connection to a pay TV service from BT or from Deutsche Telekom or Comcast, right, or Charter. So then you were able to watch Turner or whatever channel OTT on your device. And that was fairly benign. There wasn't a lot of risk there because there wasn't really a username and password that was stored. But as soon as you start monetizing services within that app, and as soon as you start putting, you know, your real username and password in there, your personal information, and you're making purchasing transactions, that application itself, not necessarily the protection of the content, but that application itself becomes a risk vector for the consumer and for the company providing the service through that app. And it's not just payment information and login, username and passwords, which often is used for many other apps, but it's also through API calls. It's a gateway to the backend systems of the companies that puts them at huge risk of exposing not only corporate information, but personal information for their consumers, which can dramatically hurt their brand. And so I think oftentimes companies forget in a content security standpoint that you also have to protect that application from being hacked, from being tampered with, from spoofing or replacing, and even replacing ads and stealing that ad revenue from that legitimate content.
Mm. What other valuable or surprising things did you learn about OTT and digital broadcasting this week?
You know, I think that maybe not learned, but just observed, and it was repeated over and over again, that often in the digital space, you know, piracy is not stealing, right? I mean, if you talk about a 20-year-old kid is watching it on YouTube, it's not stealing to them. Mm. Right, because they're not monetized, but it's the same as stealing a candy bar, a T-shirt, or what have you. This goes back to the education that when you don't pay for this, you're actually not just taking away, you know, revenue from the big brands, but it also reduces the amount those big brands can pay everybody that supports. Right, and the leagues and the rights holders that support the entire industry, so it really is a challenge. And you know, music had to figure that out in some way, shape, or form. And I've had conversations with artists that are sharing passwords from friends and their music artists, and I say, well, isn't that stealing? And like what if I played your music without you getting paid? Oh. Mm. But it's TV, it's okay, because there's another service where I have a broadcast of it. You know, I can get Fox over the air and I can get this sport over the air. Maybe not, but you can't get it here. So it's one of the things that's very interesting that there's this concept that, you know, piracy is not so bad.
Now, obviously, we would have been doing this we would have been doing this event live last year in Atlanta. How has the pandemic changed the sector for you? What effect has it had, both on the role that you have, but also on the space more generally?
I think people, you know, one, there was a big pause. And like, what are we going to do, especially in sports? But then, you know, after a few months, I think the sector in general, the media and entertainment and sports sector, figured out that there was really an opportunity to connect with the consumer in different ways and to try different things, because there was a need. There was a dramatic need for more entertainment. There were, you know, a dramatic need for distraction. And it gave a number of rights holders and content owners, you know, a little bit of freedom to say, hey, I need to try something different. I need to take a risk. Maybe we can do that seven camera angle hockey game and allow people to choose the angles they want, because we've got to do something to keep our fan base engaged and drive revenue as we're moving forward. So the acceleration and adoption of OTT consumption and distribution is incredible right now. And a lot of that is thanks to cloudification, right? If we didn't have these great cloud providers where Verimatrix could put our DRM and watermarking and any piracy services there and expand and meet the scale and demand that's happening, then it wouldn't be possible. If we stayed with that legacy type of, you know, brick and mortar, putting in servers in locations, and without that, we wouldn't be able to have the sports we have today just because of COVID. But it's dramatically accelerated, and I'm very excited about what can happen in the future to give more options for content consumption.
Yeah, and speaking of the future, I mean, fingers crossed, you know, we're going to be moving out of the pandemic over the next year, and people's behavior will get back, not necessarily to normal, but it will become more mobile, and people will be accessing content more on the go as they used to. And also sports events will become full-scale live events again. What are you hoping to put into practice over that time? And what are some of the challenges that you're looking to in that time?
I think probably from a practice standpoint is the ability to enable rights holders to connect to their consumer, to the end user through whatever platform they have that they've subscribed to, no matter where they are, in a seamless fashion, and to be able to authenticate and entitle that user based upon the subscription that they have and that they've paid for. And the example is, I live in Southern California. I'm a Lakers fan, and I pay for a Lakers subscription here, right? And there's some interesting, I don't want to use the word legacy ways agreements were put together to draw fans into the stadium itself, so you couldn't watch it out of market. Well, today the fan base is so big, there's people that might be following just an individual. And so being able to lock in that entitlement and authorization, what they've paid for, so that it can be engaged and monetized wherever the fan is what you know, I want to be looking to try to accomplish through security. And security has entitlement and authorization and protection and identification and shutdown. So, you know, those are the type of things that I want to see us moving to in the future, so that the more people are watching, the more you can monetize, right? And then it's more valuable and it needs more protection.
Okay. Thanks very much, Lee.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a great day.
Hello, I'm Matt Rogan. I've spent my career creating and scaling businesses in sports and entertainment. And now I'm talking to smart leaders inside and outside sport to get their ideas on managing change and building towards a better future. You can listen in on the Playbook podcast, a collection of candid, agenda-free conversations full of practical advice your company can work with. Get your new episodes right here on the Sports Pro feed, and check out the rest of the series wherever you get your podcasts.
All All right, we are coming to the end of this Sports Pro podcast and of our coverage of OTT USA 2021. Before we go, we will leave you with clips from a few more of our sessions on day two. Thanks again to those of you who attended and took part. One final reminder that you can relive the whole event on demand via Swapcard, or if you've not yet registered, via sportspro-ottusa.com. Thank you as well to Lou Bolden for his time, and indeed to our platinum partners, Verimatrix, Harmonic, and Limelight. And thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back with the regular podcast again very soon. Here now, though, is a last little bit from the Sports Pro OTT Summit USA. Sport in the Americas, and not just sport in the USA, was the topic of the Day 2 session Navigating LATAM, which was a reminder of the complexity and variety that exists throughout the region. And, as noted by Heidi Pellerano, Chief Commercial Officer for the soccer body CONCACAF, finding the right way through that becomes more challenging when you factor in a responsibility to grow your game.
The interesting thing about when we go back to the main concept of monetization, right? The biggest challenge that I think everybody faces, I don't think it's probably the most common universal problem, is costs and expenses of any sports infrastructure can grow at a very rapid pace. You know, if you are a league, if you're a team or club, you know, the stadium wars can really have a huge impact in your overall cost. Also, the acquisition of players, you see that incredible cost. There's always this incredible pressure as you see the evolution of consumption with fans and the globalization of sport, then that also really then puts a lot of strain on your expenses. For us as a confederation, when you think about it, our mission as a confederation, a lot of times people think is to put these competitions together. That is a pillar of our overall mission as a confederation. Our job as a confederation is to develop football across the region. You know, so that is also something that there's a lot of strategies at the grassroots level. There are strategies at the professional level, and all of that, you know, continues to increase the cost infrastructure of the organization. So with that said, right, that those are requirements, right? That's the function of the business, if you want to call it. So now there's always going to be that pressure on how can revenues keep up, right? And that's where a lot of times people can jump the con a little bit and get ahead of certain things because they're seeing, the example Platao used, right? CONMEBOL did this. Should we do that? Oh, the NBA did this. Should we do that? Oh, I saw that the New York City FC did this, or, you know, FC Barcelona did this. And you're constantly in that, kind of catching up game or like keeping up with the Joneses strategy. And that doesn't really work. You know, I think you have to kind of take a step back and be able to say, and this is a lot of what I think it's science and art a little bit of trying to manage short term, results with long term growth potential, right? And that's where a lot of the decisions that you have to think about really come into play. And, you know, making a decision around like, right, everybody wants to take ownership of their content. Why? Because I think historically, if you look at the model, there's too many hands in the pot. And the more hands there is in the pot, then you kind of wonder, you know, is that the best way for you to, you know, take ownership and control of your distribution of the revenue piece, given that you have this incredible pressure with costs always growing as well? So that's where you always have to take that look and be able to say, you know, maybe the plan is to do what CONMEBOL did in the long term. But then what are the phases to get that, right? Is that a 10-year strategic outlook? And then if that's the 10-year strategic outlook, why is that the right strategic outlook for you? You know, just because it worked for CONMEBOL doesn't mean it should work for CONCACAF, but you can take a look at what can you learn from CONMEBOL? What can you learn from FIFA? What can you learn from the NFL? Because if you look at, right, the NFL ecosystem with the NFL network and all of that, that's 300 plus people. That's a ginormous ecosystem as well that you have to start to think about. So that's why when, you know, going back to that nature, that notion of navigating Latin America, I think it's navigating yourself first in terms of where your short-term goals are, long-term goals are, and then customizing that to the particular scenario of each country and global as well. Because the one beautiful thing about sport is that it is truly global. You know, and you see that for people like us that are in the world of football, there's no other area of sport or competition that is more true, right? If you come into Brazil, right? I remember the first time I went to Brazil, it was amazing because it was the same like being, if I don't know if you've ever had the opportunity to go to the state of Texas, when you turn on the TV in Texas, it's high school football, American football, like over, it's like it consumes it. Brazil's the same way. It's like you go through 30 channels of football from the Ukraine league to the Premier League to La Liga, right? So there's a lot of competition there in all the markets, not only with your local product, international product, and then you start adding other products as well. So that's where a lot of the analysis on the strategy come in, especially because, and also as your fan evolves too, how do you address their evolving needs?
Identifying future audiences is central to the growth of any sports broadcast proposition, but that may not mean converting interest into revenue right away. In a session on selecting the right business model, Formula E Chief Media Officer Artie Dabas explained how the all-electric racing series is thinking about making young fans more valuable over time.
Yes, I mean, for us in Formula E, we've sort of coined this phase that what our target audience is called the electric generation. You know, they are a generation, they are younger, they care about the future, they care about sustainability and messages like that. But the fact is, are we actually doing our broadcast deals to match that audience right now? Have we reached that stage of sophistication, or are we only streaming to those? Absolutely not. It's about the funnel, right? And I think Dal mentioned the funnel. It's about actually reaching a wider audience and seeing how do you actually get down to this electric generation, which eventually is going to be your most valuable audience. So I think the reach is really important for us, but ultimately it is this electric generation that will be the highest value driver for us in terms of what it delivers to the brand, what it delivers to our partners and teams. But we have to go wider. We can't just say that we are only targeting the electric generation. I doubt if any sports just does that, saying we will only target, you know, 15, 6-year-olds or 34-year-olds. You have to go broader in what you're offering. But yes, there is an audience that ultimately targeting, because that's your most valuable audience. And, you know, maybe that's the one eventually that becomes your D2C audience, you know, because that's where the value driver is.
As the power of traditional models wanes, Sinclair Broadcasting Group has been clear about its belief in the potential of greater digital engagement through services like betting to grow the value of sports content and of its regional sports networks. Talking on a panel about the rising influence of interactivity, J.R. McCabe, the Sinclair Chief Business Officer of D2C and Gamification, laid out the path ahead for customized experiences.
I think personalization and customization of feeds will matter. It goes back a few things, right? What are the rights that exist? What are the restrictions from a geographic point of view? And what are the production capabilities? Because there does need to be an economic model that makes sense for those. But assuming that you look at those and you can address those issues, you do have a situation where the customization of a content experience will exist. We've already had it in many ways, right? The alternate camera angles, the court vision in basketball. You've seen ways where you can have your choice. NFL has done the same thing. You will take a look at the ability to customize an experience for you, subject to the rights and the rights management, that those experiences will become more driven by the data as we talk about it, and more driven by the community in which you interact and who you want to talk to. For example, you might want to watch in the States, you might want to watch a quarterback cam with your friends because you're playing a fantasy game and you've got the quarterback involved in the last game. Or you might want to watch a defensive secondary, again, to use football, to use U.S. football. If you want to look at hockey, you might have the same thing in a defenseman or a goalie. These different levels of experience are what you will probably build, but they'll all need to be part of one rights package that are then split based on exactly what's being offered in the market. And that's the ultimate customization. And that's just one way to look at it. The other piece, just to answer your earlier question, is, you know, the commerce around this isn't just, it is tickets clearly and merchandise, and that matters, but it's also all the other things that come with it, right? Because what happens through the data that we talk about is you create like-minded opportunities for your subscribers, your viewers, your users, that they may choose to participate in another level of commerce that's not just game or merchandise centric, but related to the team, but related to that venue, but related to that sport. And so you have this whole ability to create a downstream commerce path through this engagement and through the data that hasn't really been optimized before, and it's personalized because the consumer has given us permission.
Finally, TikTok may be the most talked about digital video platform of the past year, and through its partnerships with the likes of the NFL, the UFC, and UEFA Euro 2020, its role in sport is only deepening. In a panel on user-generated content and giving voice through social, TikTok Sports and Gaming Partnerships lead Jenna McNaney revealed plans to explore live sports streaming after successful trials with the X Games. But she was also full of advice about how any sports brand can harness the creative culture on the app.
I guess on TikTok, you really, we're all the media publishers I work with, we are encouraging them to really meet the community halfway, because the community on TikTok is what makes our app so special. And anyone who's been on our platform has seen how creative our users are. We have the most niche communities. I don't know if you've seen like Draco TikTok. That's a perfect example of UGC that's really taken off. We have Tom Felton, who ended up going live with us this week with a brand called Peacock, and he actually had never seen the first video of Harry Potter. So he streamed his reaction to that. It was so fun. But that was all UGC generated. It was all the community. We also had another really special situation happen earlier back in 2020, which was the Ratatouille musical on TikTok. And that was when our users, they had composers, musicians, singers, actors, et cetera, all sort of, they all missed Broadway, right? And they created this amazing musical of Ratatouille and the life of this rat, if anyone has seen the movie. And that was all UGC, like our community just took it and ran with it, which is so special to see. And then when it comes to sports, I think with the media publishers I work with, I'm really telling them, meet the community halfway. Don't necessarily repost UGC. You would rather engage with the content as opposed to just repurpose it, because repurposing content on TikTok doesn't tend to work very well. You want to create original content and engage with the community in a very authentic way. So an example of this is the NFL. There was actually a video that went viral on a handle called The Football Bros earlier last year. And I think it had maybe 50 million views, something really insane. It was two kids playing catch. The NFL caught wind of it. There was media publishers commenting on the video. I think almost all my partners commented on it. And the NFL picked it up and ended up actually making a commercial out of it. And it aired during playoffs last year, which was so special. So I think it just speaks to the community and making sure that our media publishers are aware of the conversation that's happening around their brands so that they can capitalize on it.
The Sports Pro podcast is published by Sports Pro Media. The producer is Ed Dixon.